You had several soldiers that either fell off cliff to their death or were thrown off cliff to their death.
Two nuclear nations battle in the Himalayas with sticks and stones. It's Thursday, June 18th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, tension tightens even more between North and South Korea. The relationship between China and Britain grow more strained. The U.S. president has his say on what to do about police violence, and an international medical aid organization says Afghanistan's capital is too violent for them. It's all on today's VOA Asia. India said Tuesday that 20 of its soldiers were killed in a clash with Chinese troops along the disputed border of the two nuclear-armed nations, the first military casualties between the two countries in 45 years. Joining us on VOA Asia is Michael Kugelman. He is Deputy Director of the Asia Program at the Wilson Center in Washington. Michael, thanks for being with us again. What has led up to this whole situation?
Well, you know, there's still a lot that's not known about what's been going on in Ladakh over the last few months. But I think what's quite clear, what we do know, is that the Chinese military has staged a number of incursions into territory that India believes to be its own. You've had several cases of Chinese soldiers basically setting up shop, pitching tents, setting up shop. Now, what's particularly troubling and surprising is that earlier this month, there had been a formal dialogue process started by the Indian and Chinese militaries that was meant to de-escalate the crisis that had emerged beginning in May and into early June. And so there, you know, the two sides were on a de-escalatory pattern. And yet then all of a sudden, we have this unbelievably tragic situation where for the first time in a number of decades, you had combat fatalities on the line of actual control, the disputed border. And we're talking about a significant number of fatalities, which appears to have been caused by some type of disagreement or dispute between Chinese and Indian soldiers that led to, you know, just really nasty, brutal, vicious fighting, punching, shoving. Crude weapons that were used, no guns or anything like that, as I understand it, but just both sides beating each other up. And it sounds like, given how difficult and unforgiving the terrain is, you had several soldiers that either fell off cliff to their death or were thrown off cliff to their death. There's also reports that there were some Indian soldiers that were abducted by Chinese forces and that they were then thrown off cliffs. We don't know the full story yet, but whatever the case, it's really quite troubling. It's unfortunate. Whenever you have something as violent and deadly as this, it's inherently escalatory. So I think it's going to be very difficult to get back to where the two sides were just a few days ago, where they were working on de-escalating.
What kind of terrain is this? We're just being told it's the Himalayas. That's my first question. And the second question is, why would not they be using guns and rifles? Why are they throwing sticks and stones at each other?
Part of it is it's just very difficult to have weapons or to have heavy weaponry at all. Just because the terrain, again, is so hard. It's very difficult to move around, much less, you know, have rocket launchers, grenades, things like that. So I think that's another factor as well. But, you know, certainly you have to assume that these soldiers are armed. They do have guns. And there had been some reports earlier on that there were several soldiers that died, and had bullet wounds. Now, other reports have contradicted that. So who really knows? But I think the concern is that given that we've had this incredibly deadly situation, it could escalate to the point that we have to worry about the possibility of exchanges of fire, so to speak, in a future crisis, in a future spat between these two sides. I mean, in such difficult terrain, that certainly is something to be concerned about.
Where do you see this going?
The messaging from the Indian side and from the Chinese side, there have been some statements released by the foreign ministries, have actually been surprisingly conciliatory. There have been plenty of conciliatory talk before this violent incident, but even now, it's continued to be conciliatory in the sense that both sides have emphasized that they're going to talk and they're going to meet. So my bottom line is I do think that things will wind down eventually, but it's just going to take a lot longer than we might have expected. You know, the root factors are still at play, and I think it's just a matter of time before you have another crisis, before you have another one. And given that you had this violent incident, you know, both sides have already climbed up the escalation ladder quite high. And so that means that it wouldn't take much for them to get back to that point where they're up high on the ladder again. So I'm cautiously optimistic for the near term, but concerned about the midterm and long term for prospects for another crisis that could be even more serious than the current one.
Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director of the Asia Program at the Wilson Center in Washington. As always, Michael, thanks.
Always a pleasure.
We invite you to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We are also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. Chinese officials describe the pandemic situation in Beijing as extremely grave. As Malaysia strives to emerge from the COVID-19 crisis, human rights campaigners say it is using the crisis as an excuse for draconian state controls. An Indonesian court fined 7 Papuan men guilty of treason Wednesday following anti-racism protest in Indonesia last year. Singapore's National Defense Research Organization says it found 5 antibodies that block COVID-19. The discovery could pave the way for them to treat cases of coronavirus. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. North Korea continues to escalate military pressure on South Korea a day after it blew up the country's de facto embassy. More from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
The Inter-Korean Liaison Office just north of the border, reduced to rubble in seconds, as shown on state TV, a symbol of crumbling inter-Korean ties. The de facto embassy was established in 2018 when the two Koreas agreed to expand economic cooperation and dialogue. Now the North is threatening to undo all of it, not only destroying the liaison building, but also threatening to redeploy troops and resume military exercises near the border. South Korea on Wednesday pushed back.
This move immediately thwarts the efforts and achievements made by the two Koreas to maintain peace on the Korean Peninsula, and the North will surely pay if these measures are put into action.
The North's campaign of aggression has been led not by Kim Jong-un, but by his sister Kim Yo-jong. Mrs. Kim once seemed mainly an aide to her brother, but has recently taken on a bigger leadership role.
This may well be a forerunner of Kim Yo-jong being charged with undertaking a mission that really seeks to exact a physical toll against South Korea to prove her credentials potentially as a senior North Korean leader.
North Korea is ostensibly angry at the South for not doing more to stop defectors and other activists from floating anti-Pyongyang leaflets and other materials across the border. But in reality, the North's anger appears to be a staged provocation cycle, possibly an attempt to force concessions from South Korea and the United States. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Happening now in Asia, Nepal's top court has ordered the government to pay for thousands of stranded migrant workers who have lost their jobs due to the new coronavirus pandemic to return home. The Supreme Court said it was the government's duty to bring back some 25,000 Nepalese citizens who were without jobs and can't afford to fly home. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thanks for being with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. London and Beijing are engaged in a heated dispute over plans to make it easier for some Hong Kong residents to emigrate to Britain. The British government announced the proposal in response to China's attempt to impose a new security law on the territory following violent anti-government protest. Hong Kong is meant to be semi-autonomous from Beijing, but critics say the new law threatens that status. Henry Ridgewell has more from London.
June 2019, hundreds of thousands of protesters filled the streets of Hong Kong, demanding the withdrawal of a bill to allow the extradition of criminal suspects to mainland China. The law was eventually abandoned, but the pro-democracy protests continued. 1 year later, the coronavirus pandemic has largely silenced the streets. In May, Beijing approved a national security bill that critics say would end Hong Kong's political freedoms. The territory's chief executive, an appointment approved by China's central government, welcomed the proposed law.
The people of Hong Kong want to see stability again.
Britain says the bill represents a clear breach of the Sino-British Joint Declaration, signed when it handed over the territory to China in 1997.
We've made a historic commitment to the people of Hong Kong to protect their autonomy and to protect their freedoms, and more importantly, so has China.
Now it seems Britain may offer an emergency exit. Britain issued so-called British nationals overseas passports to Hong Kong residents before the handover. The government says around 350,000 people currently hold such a passport, and 2.5 million people are eligible to apply. The British government is proposing to make it easier for holders of those passports and their immediate family to move to Britain with what it calls a clear pathway to citizenship after 5 years.
Implicit in the British plan is the possibility that Hong Kong could lose a very significant percentage of its talented people. From the perspective of Beijing, they want Hong Kongers to do well. They are not, however, prepared to pay any price to keep their talents in place in Hong Kong, particularly if those talents also happens to be, in quotation marks, troublemakers for Beijing.
Until the legislation is passed, British ministers have proposed emergency measures to allow BNO passport holders easier entry rights into Britain. It's the biggest change in policy since the handover, says Johnny Patterson of the advocacy group Hong Kong Watch.
It's a really significant watershed, and it signals not only an incredibly generous and meaningful immigration shift, but also a sea change in Sino-British relations, potentially.
But there is a lack of policy detail, argues Professor Steve Tsang.
I think the ambiguity is very much by design. What the British government has offered Hong Kong essentially is to send a message both to people in Hong Kong that they are not forgotten, and a message to China that there will be responses from the UK. Hopefully the Chinese government will back off.
But Beijing warns that the British citizenship offer would itself breach the 1997 Joint Declaration. Until recently, Britain agreed with that verdict. But China's attempt to impose the new security law on Hong Kong has changed the calculation in London. Henry Richwell for VOA News, London.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Taiwan jets Wednesday again had to warn off Chinese Air Force aircraft that approached the island, according to Taiwan's military. The fourth such encounter in 9 days as China steps up its activity near the Chinese claimed island. All of the big stories come your way through the day at VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Addressing weeks of growing national outcry over police violence, U.S. President Donald Trump Tuesday signed an executive order on policing. The order comes alongside separate efforts from both Republicans and Democrats in Congress focused on police reforms and the Supreme Court's decision not to re-examine the legal doctrine that shields law enforcement officers accused of misconduct. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara has the story.
This fast food restaurant in Atlanta, Georgia, was the site of the fatal shooting of a black man, Rayshard Brooks, by a white police officer last week. It was burned down by protesters, a reminder of the tension over police violence and systemic racism that has rocked the country for weeks since the death of George Floyd in a police incident in Minneapolis, Minnesota, late May. Surrounded by law enforcement on Tuesday, U.S. President Donald Trump signed an executive order on policing. He said the percentage of bad cops is tiny and calls for reform that doesn't compromise the work of good officers. He rejected the calls to reallocate police funds and resources to non-police forms of public safety, such as the social services.
Americans want law and order. They demand law and order. They may not say it. They may not be talking about it, but that's what they want. Some of them don't even know that's what they want, but that's what they want.
Trump's order includes certifying police departments, boosting information sharing to better track officers with excessive use of force complaints, creating services to address mental health, drug addiction, and homelessness. Rafael Mangual is from the conservative think tank Manhattan Institute.
It is a step in the right direction. It is not particularly far-reaching, which I don't think it should be. I think any far-reaching policy changes should come from Congress, but I do think that it is pointing itself at the right things, which are training deficiencies and building out more clarity with respect to the data on things like police misconduct and making that more publicly available.
Trump said chokeholds, such as the one applied by a policeman's knee on George Floyd's neck, should be off limits unless an officer's life is at risk. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Trump's order is not enough.
On the things they said they might have, getting rid of chokeholds, it doesn't. It's more voluntary. Putting a national registry, it doesn't. It's more voluntary.
Despite bipartisan consensus that action is necessary amid nationwide protests, there's little agreement in Congress on police reform, with competing legislative proposals from House Democrats and Senate Republicans. A key disagreement is the issue of qualified immunity, a legal doctrine that protects law enforcement officers accused of misconduct. Democrats and victims of police violence say the requirement that officers' behavior must violate clearly established laws or constitutional rights is too difficult to meet. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday refused to re-examine the doctrine. While the president did not mention racism, a key grievance of the Black Lives Matter movement, after Trump's remark, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden tweeted a video of his discussion on the subject and says systemic racism pervades every part of our society, including law enforcement, and we have to do the hard work to root it out. Patsy Whitaker-Swara, VOA News, Washington.
How dangerous is COVID-19? 80% of the cases are said to be mild. Young and healthy people are at a relatively low risk. Elderly and people with serious health conditions are at risk of fatality. If you have a cough, fever, and shortness of breath, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
The Geneva-based international health organization Médecins Sans Frontières has closed its operations in Kabul, Afghanistan, after an horrific attack on its maternity hospital in May. Brian Muller, MSF's head of programs for Afghanistan, said it was not an easy decision.
We don't know yet who is responsible for this attack. We don't know the rationale or the intent behind the attack, and we don't know who was actively targeted. Whether it was foreigners, whether it was MSF, whether it was the Hazara community or the Shia community at large. So given this lack of information, we have to err on the side of caution. And we have decided because of the uncertain security information and context that we are in, we have decided that it's a safer option to close this project for the time being.
Washington has blamed the Islamic State affiliates for the May 12th attack on the maternity hospital, which killed 24 people, including two infants. Islamic State has not claimed responsibility. MSF has been working in Dasht-e-Barchi in collaboration with the Afghan Ministry of Public Health since 2014, providing free-of-charge maternity and neonatal care.
It's going to affect a lot of people, not just on our team, but also the wider community at large, and in particular the community that we are serving in Dasht-e-Barchi. This community is a population of 1.5 million, and the hospital, the maternity section in the hospital that we were running last year affected 16,000 deliveries. So it's a huge impact, not just for our organization, but for the community at large.
The organization started working in the country in 1980, and it continues to run medical programs in the provinces of Helmand, Herat, Kandahar, Khost, and Kunduz. The International Committee of the Red Cross has warned the recent rise in targeted attacks against healthcare facilities in Afghanistan amidst the coronavirus pandemic threatened to reduce or prevent access to health services for millions of people. In a statement issued Wednesday, the Global Humanitarian Group noted that a substantial number of persons suffering COVID-19 in Afghanistan are healthcare personnel. It has put more strain on an overstretched health system, they said, that is challenged by limited coverage in conflict-related areas. The violence continues in Afghanistan as authorities said Wednesday Taliban attacks in the country's north have killed at least 17 security forces and injured about a dozen more. The violence comes as warring sides in Afghanistan are preparing to meet in Qatar later this month for a preliminary round of peace negotiations. This is VOA Asia. When the coronavirus pandemic struck, millions of senior citizens, disabled people, and others were cut off from their usual sources of food. At the same time, restaurants were forced to close and lay off workers. In San Francisco, California, a savvy baker is providing sustenance by connecting food businesses with those in need. Matt Dibble reports.
When Hang Trong started her business, Noodle Girl, she was fulfilling a dream to bring the food that she grew up with in her parents' shop in Vietnam to her new home in California.
I came here and I really miss the taste of my mom, because when I go to the restaurant, I can't find the taste that I ate like when I was young.
Then the pandemic hit and her dream was interrupted. Noodle Girl, along with every other restaurant in the San Francisco area, was forced to close for an indefinite period. Bakery owner Lenora Estrada was facing the same problem.
I knew that we just couldn't continue, like we were going to go bankrupt if I didn't immediately lay people off.
Estrada quickly mobilized, and with a large donation from a friend in the tech world, she launched a new organization, SF New Deal. It pays food businesses like Noodle Girl to prepare meals, which are delivered by volunteers to senior citizens and others desperately in need.
We're responding in cases where people's previous food supply has been disrupted in some way, and so they aren't receiving meals and they have no way to get service.
With the help of volunteers who deliver the meals, SF New Deal is a vital link between two communities in need, struggling food workers and residents sheltering at home.
Buenas, es su comida.
Okay, bye. Thank you.
Thank you so much. God bless you. Okay, bye. During these times, the only way I could deal with what's going on, I figure I would help.
Since March, the nonprofit has delivered over 270,000 meals and worked with over 80 restaurants.
This program is helping me to pay for all the things that I need in the business, keep it alive, and hopefully it can last until I figure it out.
Some of the restaurants are kind of starting to graduate. We've had a few who said, like, hey, a month ago we really needed this. Now we've been able to ramp up takeout, and so we are okay, and you can give the orders to somebody else.
Lenora Estrada is also looking forward to the time when she can just focus on baking again. For VOA News, Matt Dibble, San Francisco.
Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, which includes Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, Amy Poopyboom, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.